On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Google goes after groups, bad USB gets badder, machines are listening, and the enterprise is ready, and everything you wanted to know about hybrid cloud deployment. Twyte on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twyte.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyte, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 230, recorded March 10th, 2017. Faction Hybrid Clouds. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open source, you can download it and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit. And by Amazon Web Services. For companies to succeed today, they need a range of tools that most cloud vendors just don't offer. Amazon Web Services, the leading cloud service provider, listens to builders, offering more solutions than any other cloud provider. Check out podcast.aws and see how AWS lets builders build. Welcome to Twyte. This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. It's an awfully big topic. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis Franklin over on the right coast of the United States. Sir, you had issues with your hand. Have you solved them?
Well, they're in the process of solving themselves. Yeah, it turns out that I don't bounce quite as well as I used to. And doing a late night run a week ago, I fell and my hand took the brunt of it. So it's been reminding me that this was a very bad idea, but it's getting better. And I'm sure that the calm, healing vibes of the Twyte Riot are going to do nothing but make it better today.
See, this is why I'm a firm advocate of bed rest and video games for a long life. Curtis, you need to start taking after me. Also joining us is Mr. Lou Maresca. He is our friend up in Redmond. Lou, I like the fact that the hair is back to the super preppy style because I was a little worried last week. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. In my comfort zone, you know?
I like that. And again, I still want to know exactly how long it takes for you to do that every morning. We've got an absolutely packed show for you today. If you've ever wondered how exactly all those services that we love so much are interconnected, how we do hybrid developments and deployments, well, we're going to be bringing in an expert, a guru of all things hybrid. Matt Wallace from Faction will be joining us. But first, as always, we start off with the blips. Now, check this out. Google is going after groups. Workgroup web services have exploded in popularity over the last 2 years, with Atlassian, HipChat, Slack, and Microsoft Teams taking the lion's share of customers. Now Google wants in on the shared space market, and they're betting that some tweaks to Google Hangouts is enough to get them a seat at the big table. Yesterday, Google announced that they're splitting Hangouts into two products in order to go after the enterprise. Hangouts Chat is a shared conversation workspace, while Hangouts Meet is an audio-video conferencing tool. Google hopes that the threaded conversation, scheduled meeting, multi-participant video conferences, and a revamped backend will not just give them functionality comparable to the more established players, but also help the fortunes of the G Suite productivity suite that competes against Microsoft's Office 365. Consumers using Hangouts won't see any changes in the near future, but G Suite clients can apply for the closed beta to see if Google has done workgroups right.
Well, Dish is heading straight for 5G. Dish plans to leapfrog 4G and jump straight into 5G service delivery with the long-awaited build-out of a next-generation wireless network using its existing spectrum holdings. In an FCC filing this week, Dish has agreed to use its spectrum to build a 5G-capable network to support Internet of Things deployment strategy without a legacy 4G network. To support Internet of Things applications. The decision is noteworthy because it makes Dish the first operator to pursue a 5G deployment strategy without a legacy 4G network. Dish has made clear that while it's currently planning on moving forward with a wireless network build-out on its own, the company is also still exploring potential partnership opportunities. This is important because the major cable operators see 5G as a possible opportunity to build momentum in the mobile market after many past failed attempts. Cable companies aren't the only ones interested in Dish's wireless holdings. The existing U.S. wireless carriers are also hovering nearby, formulating their own plans for network expansion. Depending on the favorability of a deal, Dish could ultimately tie up with a cable operator or form a partnership or merger with one of the major telecom companies.
So the ubiquitous USB port is a convenience, but it also could be Achilles' heel to your devices. You probably heard about the malicious attacks when plugging into a public charging port or free USB drives given at events or maybe found in a public place. Bad USB is real, people. If it can actually creep up on you without you least expecting it. In order for this to work, USB controller chips have to be reprogrammed to become bad USB, and most don't have protection against such reprogramming. A USB could be reprogrammed to emulate keyboard, which can be then simulate the keyboard events to install malware, open ports, and affect controller chips of other USB devices. It could also spoof as a network card and change the DNS settings on your device to redirect traffic. If plugged into when you boot your PC, it can also infect the boot as a boot virus when the OS is booting up. Although there are workarounds to prevent some of this, like for instance, devices such as the USB condom that will only allow charging on a USB port and not really basically blocking all other data. If you want to protect against these digitally transmitted diseases, you also have to use something that blocks the data transfer or regulates the data transfer. And this new USG dongle may have the answer. The USG firewall dongle acts as a middleman between your device and the USB port. The dongle has two USB connectors, each tied to one ARM STM32F4 microprocessor communicating over a high-speed serial link. This internal link forms a firewall barrier that effectively blocks malicious USB commands from reaching your computer. The creator of the device, Robert Fisk, says that it only supports common devices right now, such as the keyboards, mice, and thumb drives, but it will soon support more. The device also works on Linux, Windows, and Mac OS. Never trusting any third-party USB devices is the best protection here, but for $60, this USB firewall offers a bit of peace of mind when having to deal with random public devices.
They're more useful, more easily managed, and less susceptible to malware. Oh, and don't forget, less expensive. That's the essential reasoning behind a FutureSource consulting report that broke down the growing trend of schools choosing Google Chromebooks over Apple iPads and MacBooks in the classroom. In 2014, Apple devices took a 26% share of the educational market. Last year, that share was down to 14%, while Google Chromebooks jumped to 58%. At the same time that the number of units shipped to primary and secondary schools in the United States rose from under 10 million in 2014 to 12.6 million last year. Overseas, the news is no better for Apple. Microsoft owns 56% of the 13.6 million units sold to the international educational market, with Google and Apple combining for 11% of the haul. Why is this important to the enterprise? Well, the BYOD phenomenon that took IT by storm a decade ago was largely brought about by Apple's long game of placing their products into the hands of tomorrow's enterprise users. With Google owning the U.S. market and Microsoft doing the same internationally, the question has to be asked, what will be in the hands of the next generation of enterprise users?
AT&T wants to see more women-owned businesses in tech. AT&T is eager to increase its supplier spending with diverse and women-owned businesses. To do, it would like to see more women move out of the commodity technology and into the areas where AT&T often struggles to find any supplier at all. In an interview with Light Reading's Sarah Thomas, Rachel Cutts, AT&T's Vice President of Supplier Diversity, declined to say which specific technologies AT&T is seeking suppliers for currently, but noted that AT&T wants, quote, disruptive suppliers in the technology space that can drive innovation and the best cost structure, end quote. Cutts says that current women and diversity-owned partners tend to be clustered in certain commodity technology areas, such as IT, logistics, construction, advertising, and marketing. Here's a tip for those who want to meet the challenge. AT&T does most of its business with a few big names like Ericsson, Cisco, and Qualcomm. diverse suppliers who tend to be smaller have the best shot of working with the carrier by partnering with these tier one or prime suppliers.
So think about this. The average hard drive uses about 100,000 atoms to store a single bit of information using traditional methods. Imagine if you could store a piece of data on just a single atom. IBM's researchers have struck a bit of black gold by finding a way to magnetize individual atoms of the rare earth element called holmium and use the two poles of magnetism, north and south, similar to a compass, as stand-ins for the ones and zeros. Attached to magnesium oxide, researchers can pass a current through the holmium atoms, essentially flipping their poles, simulating the traditional way of writing to magnetic drives. Since the atoms stay in whatever state they're left in, the state of the atoms can be read later on, simulating the traditional way of reading data for magnetic drives. The scanning tunneling microscope, a powerful microscope actually developed by IBM, was used to both pass the current to the atoms and also read the state of the atoms. IBM envisions that the entirety of iTunes' 35 million song music library can actually fit on a drive the size of a credit card, making computers, phones, drones, and just about anything else that needs to store information considerably thinner and lighter.
Now, this past week, WikiLeaks released thousands of CIA documents that describe, among other things, exploits for iOS, OS X, Android, Windows, Linux, and Solaris that were part of the Vault 7 toolkit. While details of the exploits were light, with no code included in the initial release, the general consensus in the IT community was meh, with no startling revelations unless you assume that U.S. intelligence did no digital information gathering at all. Still, as the industry combs over the documents and waits for Julian Assange to release the exploit code to the enterprise, a small chorus of IT professionals are using this as a jumping-off point to bring their internal security policy up to date. Specifically, the release documents contain details of exploits that have long been patched, such as the Heartbleed OpenSSL bug and OS X startup vulnerability, that can still be found in the wild thanks to lax patching and enforcement. The document dump also gives IT admins a basic playbook to watch for, with techniques like keeping small the binary size of attack payloads, port obfuscation, and efficient connection termination. In other words, though the Vault 7 dump was not really earth-shattering, good IT folk can use it to improve their security baseline. That does it for the blips. Next up, the bytes, where we're going to be talking about voice, the voice and the enterprise. That's a little teaser for you to stay tabbed. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And I got to talk to you developers out there. Look, I understand you've got a really hard job and very rarely do you get the accolades that you deserve. I mean, you're trying to change the engine in a car that's moving down the freeway at 80 miles an hour. You're trying to upgrade all of the different processes that you need. You're trying to deploy properly and yet get away from the ire and the anger of your coworkers. Well, folks, what if I told you that there was a better way to deploy? What if I told you that there was a way to deploy that could spot problems before they become issues for you and your team? Well, that's exactly what I'm telling you, because we've got GoCD. GoCD is an on-premise, open-source, continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you comprehensive pipeline modeling. This gives you the ability to model complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. With GoCD, you can model both parallel and sequential execution, and that lets you configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment. GoCD's fan-in, fan-out dependency management always does the right thing, which saves you resources and avoids spurious builds. What does this all mean? Well, in a word, visibility. Their value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance, so you know exactly how it's affecting your deployment. You get a complete picture of deployments across your organization so that you can be agile in your response and see issues before they become those show-stopping problems. GoCD also offers complete customization for your software's individual needs. It can perform tests written in most languages or frameworks with detailed logging, telling you exactly which change set and on which platform a test started breaking. You can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when you troubleshoot a broken pipeline. Now, GoCD is fantastically flexible, which is what we're looking for. It supports audible deployment. It lets you delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges to reduce the workload on you and your staff. It has extension points that let you connect any of a number of ready-written plugins or plugins that you write yourself. All of this adds up to you saying goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is an open-source project that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to the action. Gentlemen, we've hit, well, a little bit of a milestone here. Over the last couple of years, we've seen the growth of digital audio assistants, things like Cortana or Siri or Google Now, or, of course, Amazon's entry into there. It gives us an idea of the kind of data that's collected. And, of course, the enterprise is always interested in any process and any new technology that lets them have more metrics. That's exactly what voice does. Now, we've all wanted to have that digitized butler like we see in Iron Man, and fortunately, the technology is getting closer to that. But the question is, what is the future going to bring as some of the really big hitters, the ones who have been involved in this field for years and years, actually start to push more and more of their resources towards that goal? We've got Apple, IBM, AT&T, Google, and Microsoft all spending millions, if not billions, to build more advanced, more capable speech recognition systems that don't just do speech-to-text translation, but also do a little bit of deep neural networking. They have a little bit of artificial intelligence so that they can now determine the difference in what you're saying, not just by the words, but by the context and even the tone of your voice. Lou, this is a bit of a blue sky thing. And people think about this and they say, okay, there's probably something there. There's definitely profit to be made. But when they think about voice and the enterprise, people often draw a blank. What would you say is one of the things that we're going to start to see as voice becomes more and more ubiquitous and as the enterprise starts using those data points?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're starting to see the advent of it. I mean, originally, you know, voice recognition and all these other types of recognitions were using statistical machine translation. And, you know, now that they're using deep neural networks and deep learning, they're starting to kind of grow outside their box. And one area that you'll definitely see is, you know, I see today already is it's kind of the simulation within, you know, customer service. When you call somebody and you start to talk to them, you know, I've actually called some companies that are using some of these services where the person talking back to you almost sounds like they're an operator or somebody, a customer service agent, you know, where you say, hey, I need to check my bill or I need to pay something. And it's not like the older way of doing things where you have to pick A through F or whatever. It's just a natural kind of discussion. And so that alone, along with bots and other chat services as well, will help, you know, any enterprise, any company with, you know, the service oriented aspect of it, you know, and these companies like, you know, Amazon AI and, you know, the Microsoft Cognitive Services, they're offering up to, you know, their APIs and their ability to kind of do this services across the board so that, you know, other companies can come up with new ideas and implement them within the enterprise as well, or businesses, or even small and medium businesses as well. You know, from speech recognition to, you know, translation, you know, custom speech recognition, you know, understanding noise in the background and kind of getting rid of that and understanding people's accents. And you know, there's so much application for it here. But you're starting to see the advent of it, like I said, especially in places like customer service.
You know, this all started back in the 1980s. I remember the very first time I got a copy of, was it Dragon? I think it was called Simply Speaking. It was interesting. It was useful. It came with its own headset, and it was the first chance that you got to do something that you had seen on Star Trek for so many years, which is speak to your computer. It kind of worked. It was a continuous speech recognition system, but it used up a lot of power. It was often very clunky, and this is very familiar to the people who use these systems today. You'd find yourself repeating the same thing over and over again to get just the right intonation and just the right command. But we're getting better. I mean, yes, we still have that annoyance, but there's absolutely no argument against the fact that the technology is getting closer and closer to being usable mainstream for everybody. Curtis, you actually had a prediction that we would be moving to these systems more quickly than we wouldn't. Do you think your prediction is going to come true sooner than you originally imagined?
I actually do. I had said I think that within 5 years that voice is going to be our primary way of interacting with computers. I suspect that's going to be true for most people within the next 18 months to 2 years. And here's why. As Lou said, we're seeing a lot of very large companies that provide the basic computing infrastructures, whether it be the hardware, the operating system, or a cloud basis, going with a voice interaction. We're seeing each of them specialize in a slightly different aspect of this, but they're all moving in that direction. And we're seeing the devices themselves get much more competent at being voice relatable devices. As a matter of fact, I'm convinced that the Apple EarPods that so many people have said are a failure aren't in fact a failure. What they are is the first device that's designed to be a primary interface to your computing environment. So I think we're going to move forward very quickly. I think we're going to see it in a lot of business aspects. And interestingly enough, I think it's the salespeople and folks in development who are going to be leading the way towards life as a voice computing environment.
It's interesting because just a couple of months ago, I was in Rome. We were having a thing for the Jesuits. We had gathered together over 200 Jesuits from around the world. And in one room, we had, 12 languages, 12 language primary languages that were spoken in a bunch of dialects. And we had an entire balcony filled with translators. These were other Jesuits who were doing translations from one language to another. And in some cases, it got really complicated because you'd have to go from Czechoslovakian to Russian to Spanish to French to English. And it was this really strange chain that took forever. And one of the things that I actually tested on a very, very small basis was using Microsoft's translator with Skype for Business. And in every single case, bar none, it did a translation better, and it got the context better than a human who was actually trained to do translation, which I found that phenomenal. And Curtis, I think you're right. I think that's the wearable technology that we've been waiting for. It's not a piece of tech that we strap onto our body and then we use our eyes to look at. It's something that uses other senses that we have and expands the way that we interact with computers. Lou, what do you think about this? This idea that Curtis has that this, you know, this is this entree of this new generation of interface. Right now, I'm still kind of stuck on the fact that I have to repeat a command 5 or 6 times. And if I have to do that once, it just destroys the entire experience for me. But eventually, we're going to get past that, right? I mean, I think the big roadblock was the fact that early devices tried to do all the processing inside the device, and that was very cumbersome, and it required a lot of hardware. Now that we are using remote server farms to do it, it seems much more possible, much more capable.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, with we live in the information age, but there's still a lot of roadblocks when it comes to communication because, you know, there's no universal language out there. And I think that, you know, you bring up a good point. I think, you know, translation is one of the big ones. I think that, you know, reducing that, everyone wants a Jarvis, right? And imagine having a Jarvis walking around and you're talking to somebody, you know, in person and then being able to translate back and forth and you talking just natural language to them, and them talking natural language back to you. I mean, the power on that is just astronomical. I think that reducing those roadblocks going forward is something that all companies are trying to do. And I think that you're going to start seeing this, come out of nowhere. And with the, especially in smaller devices and smaller things, and just being able to naturally communicate across the board, without having these roadblocks anymore, it can open things up for business. It can open things up for trade. It can open things up for new technologies. And I think that I think you're definitely going to start seeing this being adapted soon. And especially if they open source some of this stuff and a lot of the services are free to use and you can start using them and building your own ideas around them and as well as and having them learn and understand things that you want them to learn and understand. I think, that's where the power is for sure.
Okay. Now we do have to move into another part of the story. It's the second enterprise bite, but I think it's very much connected. We have a very intelligent audience, and of course, they understand that there's a lot of promise here. There's a lot of potential for profit in the enterprise. There's a lot of ways that the enterprise could use this sort of technology to improve their offerings. However, there is one huge white elephant in the room, and that's privacy. The fact that we are leveraging outsourced computing power, big data centers that our mobile devices are connected to, in order to do this context analysis, it means that our conversations continuously are being sent someplace else. That's an issue. That's a concern that I think we need to address, especially in the enterprise. Curtis, I want to throw this one to you first because Lou got the last one first. What what are the issues that you start to see as you think of the enterprise using this more often? And by the way, we are now getting to that part of the show where we could accidentally use the trigger words for the various voice assistants. So be very careful about what you say. What's your take?
Well, to me, the big thing that is involved is just how the encryption works between the endpoints, the devices that are in the user hands, and the services that are actually doing the translation. In general, I think that we've seen most of these devices that go, you know, across some flavor of a web-based interface, using at least an HTTPS. Using SSL as the most rudimentary kind of encryption, and that's a right step. We also know, courtesy of the WikiLeaks dump, WikiLeaks Vault 7, that there is malware out there that is capable of grabbing data before it hits the encryption, before it goes into that VPN tunnel. So I think that the enterprises are going to have to figure out their relationships with some of these companies, whether it be Google, Amazon, or Microsoft, or Apple, and work on consistent long duration tunnels that encrypt all of this traffic, especially from major office back to the cloud service. I think there are a lot of things to be negotiated, but by and large, I feel like the privacy is one of those things that is a work in progress. It's not that people are ignoring it. It's just in many cases, they see benefit that makes it worthwhile to be one or two steps ahead of where the best security would be.
And actually, that's a very good point, because the very first thing that we think of whenever we think of a piece of technology that might be in our home, in our car, on our mobile device, that is always recording us, always setting off our streams, is that someone might misuse it. And yes, we've seen some very clever malware that can exist on a home network. In fact, I've seen two proofs of concept that can infect some of the most popular routers, essentially acting as man in the middle for its own network, intercepting Amazon's traffic. I have to say, not say the trigger word, Amazon's traffic before it gets encrypted, and therefore give them the ability to listen to anything that your little Amazon unit can hear. And that's scary. However, there is another part to this, and this is the story I want to bring up. This was brought to us by Ars Technica, where they were talking about the case that's occurring right now where Amazon's voice assistant may actually hold the clues to solving a murder. And this is a brand new area of digital law, where what kind of expectation of privacy do you have if there's a device that's always on, always listening, and always sending information back? And you've got Amazon saying, look, we're not saying we won't give this to you, but you have to show us first, where is the line? When do we give this to you? When is it proper to give it to you? And when is it not? Lou, it's these bright line cases that often decide how this technology is going to be used in coming generations. This seems pretty clear that we'd want to share the information, right? I mean, what could you offer me that says maybe this is not a clear, bright line division between when we share and when we don't?
You know, it's not really clear. I mean, I think that, you know, I think the one of the things that you'll notice is that, you know, some of these systems require, like, you know, speech recognition is one of them, is in order for them to improve these systems, they have to sample more and more samplings, right? And the only for them to do that, they have to have the ability to produce and gain those samples. And by people using their devices and their APIs and so on is a way for them to do that. And I think that, you know, like Curtis said, as long as you're securing the data during transfer, you know, there shouldn't be really worry depending on, you know, as long as they're claiming that they're not using it for any advertising or anything like that. So it's all dependent on what the service is claiming it's going to do with this data. But again, you know, then there's the flip side too. There's, you know, the devil's advocate is that, you know, sooner or later, your voice could be your identity. And I think that, I mean, it is already, right? So I think that, you know, them sampling this information and storing it somewhere could be a threat to multiple people. And so I think there's also a limitation to how long data should be stored and used for a purpose. And I think that that's one thing that services should be doing is saying, hey, we're going to take your data, your information, your voice, your identity, and we're going to use it just for research purposes. But then after 120 days or 180 days, we're going to get rid of it. And I think that that would help consumers, I think, a little bit more from a privacy perspective. And at least as long as they're doing that, feel a little bit more about helping kind of these services move along. But I think that there's always going to be questions about this and whether we should be sharing, whether we shouldn't should be sharing.
I like that. That's a very non-knee-jerk reaction. It reminds me, a few years back, Leo Laporte did an episode, I think it was a Twit, where he showed people exactly what Google was storing every time you use their voice assistant, and then it had your recording. And that kind of shocked people. Some people didn't know that that was actually being recorded. Some people definitely didn't know that you could access that months and months and years later. In this particular case, can you imagine, Curtis, people not knowing that it's not the trigger word that starts the recording, but that it's always being sent? It's, there's always the ability for Amazon to be receiving that stream of data. What's your take? I mean, is it okay with you to take Lou's suggestion and say, look, this is fine as long as we have very clearly defined roles for this data? It can be kept this long, it can be used for this. Or is this a bigger issue that needs to be tackled before voice assistants become entirely mainstream?
I'm going to give you a yes as the answer, because I think that we're looking at two different cases. For the users, the consumers, then I think the answer is no. They have no idea of how this works any more than most consumers 20 years ago could have told you in any real term how the circuit switch telephone system worked. They just know that it works. They trust that the companies will not hurt them, and they'll just sprinkle it with pixie dust and see everything working well. On the enterprise, it's a different story, because the enterprise should have people in IT who do know how this works, who do look at things like the EULAs, who do understand what the policies are, not only within the enterprise, but at the cloud partners. And I think for enterprise customers who are now beginning to use this, there need to be some very clear things spelled out, especially as involve regulatory compliance in both the financial and the healthcare industries about precisely how these devices can be used and precisely what needs to happen before that use can expand.
Well, gentlemen, I think we made it through this entire segment without triggering a voice assistant once. So we get accolades for that. But now it's time for us to move on to our guest. In just a moment, we're going to be bringing in Matt Wallace. He is the VP of Product at Faction. He's going to explain to us exactly how you build the perfect hybrid system. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, TWiET is brought to you by Amazon Web Services. AWS provides a robust and scalable platform to help builders of all types and sizes innovate quickly with twice the compliance certifications and the largest global footprint of any cloud vendor. Now, AWS does the heavy lifting of IT infrastructure so that builders like you can focus on what you do best, which is to build product, not networks. AWS provides the most comprehensive set of features for builders, releasing new features at a faster rate than anybody else, with over 1,000 new features in 2016 alone. Their services support virtually any cloud workload, with more than 70 services that range from compute storage, networking, database, analytics, application services, deployment management, and mobile. By listening to what builders actually want and need, AWS has been adding more capabilities than any other cloud provider. Now, AWS storage solutions are designed to deliver secured, scalable, and durable storage for businesses looking to achieve efficiency and scalability within their backup and recovery environments without the need for on-premise infrastructure. They also offer the widest global reach of any cloud provider and allow you to choose in which region your data resides to minimize latency and cost, as well as, of course, to address regulatory requirements. You know that you want to choose where your data is stored, and with AWS, you can do exactly that. You have complete control of your data. With AWS, startups can act like enterprises, and enterprises can be nimble like startups. Whether you're new to AWS or have experience with AWS, they want to provide you the right resources to support your success and help you do amazing things. Learn more at podcast.aws. That's podcast.aws. And we thank Amazon Web Services for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's time for my favorite part of every show, where we bring in our guest who's ready to drop knowledge on the Twiet Right. And this time I bring Matt Wallace. He is the VP of Product Management and Product Development Solutions Marketing over at Faction. Matt, thank you very much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you.
And oh, by the way, I should mention, thank you very much for pinch hitting. This is always something that we love. We did have a dropout. I shouldn't be saying that, but I very much appreciate the fact that you were willing to be on the show on such short notice, especially with such impressive technology. Can you explain to us, what is Faction? What is it that you do?
Sure. Well, Faction is a hosted private cloud provider. So what we do is we deploy infrastructure, data center space, and all the tools and technology that people need to kind of replace their enterprise environments, replace their existing enterprise data centers, move to the cloud. We give them the ability to then take that private infrastructure that we run for them and easily cross connect it into public clouds as well, so they can kind of take advantage of those features and that scalability while having a footprint for their environment where they can use more of the people, processes, technology they already have in place, and kind of use those together in what we call hybrid cloud.
It's interesting because Faction has been around before the buzzword hybrid cloud came into being. When people were still thinking of either storing it on your premise, in your network, on your campus, or hiring a colo to store your servers elsewhere, Faction was already trying to put together the ideas that would become this wonderful hybrid of web services that we have today. Where would you say was really the moment, the year, the advancement that made people realize that they could trust a hybrid development?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I feel like realistically, if you look at the trend, you know, all the way back in 2011, you had this sort of early adopter part of the adoption curve. I think, you know, when you look at the mainstream adoption, it was probably only about 2 years ago when people started to broadly hear that hybrid cloud term and start to get used to the idea of deploying into those hybrid topologies. I think historically, people have had a lot of concern about security, data sovereignty, and those sorts of considerations that made them a little bit reluctant to embrace cloud in general. In fact, I think, you know, the growth in private cloud owes some of its growth to people who were interested in the kind of benefits that they got from the public cloud providers, but didn't want to entrust all that data to infrastructure where they didn't have good visibility into where it lived and how it was operated.
Right, right. Okay. Now, most of our audience will understand what a hybrid deployment looks like now. It typically means I maintain something on-premise and then I use a web service or maybe even a colo in order to balance my load and to have some sort of reliability, some sort of redundancy. However, we've come to realize that there is so much more to offer if you are willing to look at a hybrid solution as a way to interconnect much faster with the other services upon which you may be dependent or the other services upon which your customers may be dependent. How do you design that? I mean, if I'm a customer coming to Faction saying, look, I do this service and I would like to be very closely related to X, Y, and Z service as well because we do a lot of dependencies with them. How do I design that? How do I make sure that I'm going to the right provider to make sure I'm going to get the fastest speeds possible for the people I service?
Sure. I think, first of all, you really have to work with somebody who has a history of interconnection. You know, Faction got its start dealing with this sort of hybrid situation about 7 years ago because we had customers who were early consumers of our private cloud solution. And rather than the sort of off-premise plus use the public cloud version that, you know, people kind of associate with hybrid cloud now, we had customers who had significant co-location footprints in the markets in which we operated. And one of the challenges we had was really seamlessly and easily tying their co-location environments into the cloud offerings that we were providing them. And so we have this now 7-year history, and we actually have some patented IP around making those interconnections work together really easily. I think having somebody who has, first of all, the geographic diversity to make sure that you can connect to partners in all the regions that you'd want to connect to your partners in is important. I think having a partner that has really the broad experience of interconnecting in different types of ways. I mean, I think one thing that we recognize is that this hybrid topology is sufficiently novel that not everybody does this in a sort of standardized way. This isn't like the internet where, you know, you kind of plug in, you expect your computer to get its address and immediately just go out and talk to things. There's a lot of nuance in how the allocation of networks at the enterprise level and the cloud level interoperate with each other, both at layer two, which is the sort of VLAN technology, as well as layer three, when the kind of subnets and the routing get into play, and how those tie into each public cloud provider is different. So there's a lot of complexity. And that's one of the things we bring to the table for our customers, is that expertise in really connecting those diverse environments.
Okay, when you talk about interconnecting diverse environments, are we talking about, is this just federation? Is this a system of, say, two service providers agreeing on some standards that they're going to use in order to connect their resources to have a better overall ecosystem? Is that the same solution, or is this something a little bit different?
Yeah, I mean, I think that everybody could probably debate, you know, the terminology. When I think of the term federation, I think of the sort of management plane and the control infrastructure and things that really provide the governance across a multitude of clouds. I think when we're talking about hybrid cloud at the network level and the interconnection level, we're talking about all the technologies that come into play, cross-connecting all these different types of environments at the various layers. So whether it's Ethernet, fiber optics, WAN links, MPLS, VPLS in order to get network traffic there, how you deal with VLANs on one side, VLANs on another side, or other types of virtual networks that might be extended by a technology like VXLAN, or at layer three, and how you deal with routing tables and those types of networks communicating across a multitude of clouds. And I think federation plays a role in the sense that, you know, in order to make all this work in a way that's sustainable, a way that you can automate and orchestrate, a way that you can debug when there are issues, I think then federation comes into play as the sort of governance framework that allows you to go and deal with the kind of knowledge side of things in order to have a sort of management handle on all those sorts of networks. And then, of course, you know, there's workloads that run in different environments. A lot of hybrid cloud topologies are, you know, a VMware environment where people have often taken a workload they've historically run for, you know, sometimes as much as a decade on a VMware platform and moved it into one of these private cloud environments. And then they're using this sort of hybrid philosophy to extend those VMware environments into some of the public clouds so they can take advantage there of the burstability, of the kind of sometimes geographic diversity, or different types of services like Lambda or Kinesis that they don't get on the sort of traditional platform that they have. Sometimes they're doing those hybrid topologies to blend their sort of old school applications with some cloud native things that they're developing in-house.
When they start to look at that process, when they start to look at blending their in-house solutions along with some cloud services, What would you say would be some of the most significant mistakes that IT managers and execs will make when they're making this transition, when they're looking at who they sign up with? What is the most often seen error in the deployment?
Well, interestingly, I think the most significant mistake that people make is actually starting to address the technology before they address the business considerations behind it. So a lot of people, you know, tend to look at this as a, how can we do this? And if you look at the sort of statistics about these types of projects and which ones get successfully to fruition versus not, the key differentiator is that the ones that start with a sort of business objective-led approach where they go, this is what we want to accomplish, this is why we want to accomplish, here's what success looks like at the end, those are actually the projects that end up making it to the finish line. And there's a certain level of science project work where it begins as a technology problem, and they look at it merely from that level. And that's where things tend to fall apart, because sometimes you have really smart people who are doing really cool work, but they're kind of solving the wrong problem at the end of the day. And so they don't meet the objectives that they should be.
Yeah, I could see that being an issue with an executive who says, well, I've heard we need to be in the cloud. I've heard we need to have a hybrid solution. And so therefore, we're going to do this. Not considering, well, I mean, one of the main reasons why we want to do this is for the interconnection agreements. We want to choose a provider who's going to put us next to resources that will actually help us. It's no longer as easy as saying, well, we want data in multiple places. It's now saying we want data in strategic places. So how do they choose those strategic places? I guess this is another way of asking a question that's come up in our chat room from both Emily the Strange and JJ4884, where they say, well, you know, what is it that separates faction? When a client comes to you, what do you offer that you think is your ballywick? What kind of interconnection expertise can you offer them that they couldn't get from a competitor?
Sure, absolutely. Well, so, I mean, this is a sort of timely question in the sense that we just got the issue notice in the past few weeks from the USPTO on some of our intellectual property around doing some of these cross connects for hybrid networking. So, I mean, it's some recognition that we're a true pioneer in the area. You know, faction kind of picked its locations in a certain sense in the beginning so that we would have really low latency to a broad set of regions across the United States. So we run 6 cloud nodes right now across the U.S. Along the West Coast, the East Coast in New York and Atlanta, Denver and Chicago, more towards the middle of the country with a node in Ashburn that's coming soon. And, you know, those 6 nodes that we have actually put 90% of the population of the United States within about 10 milliseconds of latency. And then if you look at what we're doing in Virginia, when you kind of complement where we began in Seattle and Santa Clara, you add in the Virginia node, you'll notice that puts us really close to the public cloud nodes that tend to be really deeply populated on those coastal areas. And I think you've completely nailed it when you are asking the question about, you know, data locality, because data gravity is really the consideration that is absolutely driving people's hybrid cloud topologies. It's not really that useful to do a hybrid topology where you take your, you know, a traditional workload and connect it to a public cloud. If you have to do it over WAN link, where you might have, you know, 30, 40, 60, 80 milliseconds of latency, where it's really expensive and difficult to get the bandwidth you need. I think anybody who's looked at getting, you know, gigabits of connectivity into a public cloud from a remote location has discovered that it's not necessarily the most economical way to access those environments. I think what Faction brings to the table is, aside from the fact that we can deploy this infrastructure for people, they get to, you know, forget about the concerns of the data center side of things. They get to forget about the concerns of standing up the virtual infrastructure, and they can actually focus on running their applications instead. We put that really close to these public clouds, and we can deliver those turnkey circuits into the public cloud providers in a really simple way. We don't require any sort of reconfiguration. We do all the setup. People don't have to change their IP addresses. They don't have to change the VLANs that they've been using traditionally. So we make it a real kind of easy button for making that transition to those hybrid cloud environments. And then additionally, you know, I notice you've got our map up here, and we've got this whole ecosystem that we've built around data centers, where in each of the markets where we build a cloud node, we also run our own dark fiber network. So we can connect all the data centers in that area that have a lot of customers and actually do virtual circuits between data centers, between the public clouds, between our cloud nodes, as well as connecting to places like internet exchanges where we can exchange traffic for layer 3.
How important was it for Faction to actually use your own fiber runs, your own dark fiber? Because there are some of your competitors, and I've used many of their services, and they work quite nicely, run more virtual networks. They'll use shared networks that have dedicated speed and they have really, really good terms of service. But for you, it seems that you wanted to own the network. That was a big part of your strategy. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really critical for us to own the networking pieces in these markets. And partially, it's just because of the enormous amount of bandwidth you can drive through fiber optics. You know, by having a, you know, fiber that we're leasing in the ground and the ability to turn up basically any number of wavelengths over that, it means that we can run hundreds and hundreds of gigabits of internet traffic. So I shouldn't say internet traffic, but of network traffic in those metro areas, which allows us to really scale things for our customers without adding a lot of costs. So we have customers sometimes that may have partners or may want to connect into clouds from one of the data centers in our metro area. And when it comes to a conversation about, well, what do I do to get 10 gigabits per second into this site? It's no longer a matter of thousands and thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars to do that, because the dark fiber wavelengths are so inexpensive for us to turn up with our DWM gear. So I think the key thing there really is about cost, because, you know, it's important for us to basically deliver that connectivity with a lot of value.
All right. Now, I do want to talk a little bit about data lock-in, and for that, we got to bring in my co-host because they're experts in this, specifically with Lou. Lou, you had a question about this because you have a lot of IT folk, enterprise folk, who will say, well, if I'm going to do a solution, it's going to be with AWS or it's going to be with Microsoft Azure. I want to use that ecosystem. I don't care if it's locked in. What would you say are the issues concerning this whole lock-in of your data?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what you've seen is, and it's no secret, I mean, hybrid cloud and private cloud have pretty low adoption rates over the last year. And I think that the reason is, you know, people were fearing that they, you know, what they call a data lock-in, which is, you know, people wanted to keep their data where it was at. And the cost to move it to the cloud was much greater than them, you know, having to actually move the data and find new services to do it. And I think that fear seems to almost have gone away. We've seen a lot of organizations that they would rather see and have access to innovation and more importantly, you know, different services that add value to their application and to their data than having to worry about moving the data later on. And I think that, you know, this is something interesting because there are some aspects of business and so on, like for instance financial, that would rather keep their data in one place and offer up this solution of hybrid and so on. But I think that there are industries that would rather the cost of just moving the data now and innovating and getting access to all the innovation. So I'd be curious to find out. I mean, what kind of trending are we seeing? Are we seeing a lot of companies, you know, forced to kind of stay the data locked in and then, you know, kind of going to the hybrid model, or are they or are they moving, or do they want to move?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really fascinating question. I think when you look at the sort of hybrid, I think the traditional version of hybrid really was a lot of people taking those traditional enterprise applications and trying to find some way to get them closer to the public clouds, or maybe sometimes just simply out of their data center. You know, we have a great deal of customers who came to us looking for a more cloud-focused type of environment where they didn't need to worry about scaling for themselves, where they didn't have to engage in those hardware refresh cycles, where they were constantly planning, you know, the next spend and so on. But they still had sometimes really specific things that they needed that were still stuck in the physical world, whether those were tape backup archives or specific servers with things like a certain type of graphics card they needed for a VDI environment, things like that. And they came to us to build hybrid clouds between the co-location footprint that they would use to land some of their equipment and then our private cloud side. I think the trend now is more towards, you know, building the private clouds with the public cloud side of things. But as you pointed out, there's a huge amount of value being driven by the enormous amount of innovations going on in the public cloud space. But I think one of the things that you find is that, you know, as companies get to really large scale, one of the things that we're hearing more and more is that, you know, companies didn't really anticipate how large their spend in those environments would become when they really got to a very large scale. And I think in the future, especially when you fast forward out a couple of years from now, we're going to see most of the adoption in private cloud coming not from people migrating those traditional applications in, but actually people who are taking workloads out of the public cloud because they find that they can more specifically size it and build things that are slightly more customized that run those steady state workloads really well. And I think when you see that transition out of those public clouds, as we've heard of companies like Zynga, for example, and so on doing, where they take enormous public cloud footprints and move to a privatized environment, I think in that case, a lot we'll see in the future because of this growth in the hybrid side and the advancements in the networking piece, I think we'll see them keep a leg in the public clouds to continue to take advantage of the innovations there that make sense and the agility that that offers while continuing to kind of have the best environment for their private workload that kind of is more steady state and more well-known.
Well, I wanted to drop back and ask a little bit more about your networking, because it seems to me that that's a critical part of what you're doing. And I'm curious now, are you basically becoming an MPLS network provider end-to-end for some of your customers? And in relying so heavily on that fiber plant that you've built out, does that in many ways limit the geographical reach of your customer base? In other words, if you have customers who don't have physical plant somewhere close to one of your big fiber hubs, does that diminish the value of what you're able to provide for them?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I feel like, first of all, we have tons of customers that connect to us over MPLS and VPLS. So the WAN link is still a strong consideration. People out there have their remote offices, their branch offices, their headquarters, sometimes enterprise data centers that they're keeping around. They often work with us to deploy networks that run into our environment. In fact, one of the cool things about the sort of network plant that you were describing is that after customers bring an MPLS or a VPLS link in a faction kind of as a hub, we then have the ability to connect them to multiple destinations. And obviously, you know, we're not the only solution for that. If you look at like what Level 3 does with their Cloud Connect offering, they're obviously offering people there the ability through those E-Link interfaces to go and connect out to multiple sites over the WAN. But because we have this sort of hub that's based on this LAN technology, once people bring a WAN link into us, we can obviously make it more economical and high bandwidth to kind of connect into those different sites from there. Now, Faction, because we have this infrastructure that we've built out that's operating at scale, you know, we often can provide this sort of data lake in the middle there where they can connect off to multiple sites. And MPLS, you know, to answer more of the original question, doesn't really play a huge role in our network. We have a lot of customers that use MPLS to arrive at us as a destination. And over certain parts of our network, we definitely do run, VPLS. But we also do a whole ton of other networking technologies here. And in different places, we are using, you know, the traditional 802.1Q VLAN tagging. We have 802.1AD Q&Q tagging. We use VXLAN. We use virtualized network gateways that we've basically deployed in order to do different types of things like engage in routing or extend networks. And we're actually, as far as I know, the only service provider that I know of that actually uses Trill Fabric. So we actually can assign customers virtual fabric IDs where they can have their entire own set of VLANs, so they can actually create and maintain their entire set of addressable virtual networks. And we can use the common switching fabric, so we can do that in a very economical and extendable way, a sort of standardized way for our customers. And we kind of blend all these technologies together with our sort of secret networking sauce in order to enable all this connectivity.
We've actually got a good question in the chat room, again, from Emily the Strain. She's on it today, who wants to know, okay, so how does this work? I mean, this sounds good, and we understand that you've built out a fantastic infrastructure and that you can be sort of the management layer for determining where exactly my data goes and where my services interconnect with other services. But if I'm running my own 10,000-seat enterprise, how do I come to Faction? I've got data in AWS. I've got services running on the Azure cloud. How does Faction help me tie that all together with what I might have on premise?
Yeah, I mean, actually, the best thing I think about Faction is really that we can deal with networking connections of all kinds. So we don't actually need to say you have to connect in this way. So we have a ton of customers that come to us directly across the internet. We have a huge internet bandwidth available. We have customers that put in VPN appliances, either virtual or physical, that we can offer as a service, and then they can bring all of that traffic to us directly over the public internet. If they want to come to us over VPLS or MPLS, we can support those. A lot of our customers are actually engaged already with co-location environments in the metro areas that we operate. So if you look at, you know, the co-location density in a market like Denver or a market like Santa Clara or a market like Ashburn, where we're opening up, there's a huge amount of, you know, wholesale and retail data center space there. And if a customer is in those environments, that's where that fiber network comes into play. And a lot of times that looks like them just getting a cross connect from their co-location provider into a piece of gear that we have in that facility. And then we can actually open up networks for them in that facility that tie them back in our cloud nodes and off into the public cloud providers as well. So it actually ends up becoming real. It opens up a lot of optionality for the customers in the way that they connect. And, you know, for the ones that are in the metro area, we have those fiber footprints. It's just enhanced because it's sort of virtually unlimited bandwidth from the fiber perspective.
And to take a Blue's point, it really eliminates the lock-in. You'll work with anything, wherever their data is coming from, wherever their services need to go. You can just be there to make sure that they've got the most efficient path possible.
Exactly. And I think one of the, to use an example of one of our partners, NetApp has started offering a service called NetApp Private Storage as a Service. And they have this vision for multi-cloud connected storage where you can have their what they call data fabric technology in order to tie different types of data sources, whether those are remote offices, branch offices, different types of data centers, and blend those all into one kind of management fabric. And they tapped us to actually land storage nodes in key locations so that customers could use that as a centralized repository for storage, but then have on-demand connectivity into multiple cloud providers to avoid that lock-in so that they can actually have data that can be read. We're actually turn up instances inside of Amazon, read data directly out of the Faction cloud, also do it in Azure, also do it in Google, also do it in SoftLayer all at the same time. In fact, we have examples. We have NFS exports, and people are actually accessing those from four clouds at the same time.
Right. One last question before Emily Lestrange, because this is actually a good one. She was wondering, if she wanted to put equipment into one of your colos, one of your strategically located colos, how would she do that? Does it work just like a standard colo operating agreement, or does Faction do something a little bit differently? Is it all virtual appliances?
Right. We actually, Faction, is differentiated, I think, from certain types of cloud providers, and that we chose very intentionally to not tie ourselves into only being in locations where we could build out data centers. So we actually work with, premier tier 3+ data centers in the markets that we're in. So for example, if you are, our Denver cloud node is actually located in a facility run by Fortrust. And if you want to have a small amount of colocation from us, like let's say you wanted to bring in a handful of servers, we absolutely can sell you a little bit of rack space, and our team can go and deploy your system in, connect it up, and operate remote hands for you. But if you want to have, racks and racks of gear, then we actually refer you directly to our partners, and we can work with them and you to kind of build the correct topology to land the physical gear that you have, and then wire cross connects directly into our stack so that we can then provide you network services out of that same facility, provide you cloud services that interact directly with the equipment that you have in colocation, connect that colocation environment directly off into the public cloud as well.
So Emily Lestrange, the answer is yes. Folks, I'm sorry, but you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 strands of Dark Fiber. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible, especially to our guest, Mr. Matt Wallace. Again, he is the VP of Product Management and Product Development, so Solutions Marketing at Faction. Matt, could you please tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find Faction, where they can read up about what you might be able to do for their next deployment?
Sure, absolutely. FactionInc.com is the website. Love to have more people visit there. We actually are Faction Inc. on Twitter as well. I'm Matt Wallace on Twitter, and you can reach out to me there on Twitter, on LinkedIn. We're available. Love to have people come and visit through the website. We have the full vein of chat options, as well as if you're interested in this particular topic. We recently published a hybrid cloud ebook that you can download from our site that actually talks about not only this hybrid cloud from the very technological perspective, but it goes into microservices architectures and why people would want to pursue hybrid cloud from an application development standpoint to kind of help them make this transition. So definitely please do reach out, download that ebook, and get in touch.
And of course, Matt, we're going to try to have you back on Twyatt for doing us a solid. We're going to make sure you make it back on the show. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for dropping the knowledge about Faction.
Thank you.
And of course, I have to thank my co-hosts. They are the men without whom we could not have This Week in Enterprise Tech. They are the wind beneath my wings. They are the rise in my ocean. They are the men who wear funny hats. Of course, we got to start with Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, where can people find you, and what will you be up to in the coming week?
Well, you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM, and lots of stuff coming out soon. So please check out all my work on my daily job is from serum.dynamics.com.
Fantastic. And Curtis, assuming, of course, that you don't dislocate your other hand, what will you be up to, and where can we find you?
I'm covering more and more security stuff for Light Reading, getting ready for some exciting news coming up in the month of April. Lots of preparation to go through there. got some pretty good stories coming up, including how improvements in development process might save us from episodes like the cloud bleed that hit us a couple of weeks ago. So look for me over on lightreading.com. And as always, follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA.
Curtis, Lou, again, thank you so very, very much. And thanks to you, to the person who drops by each and every single week. We wouldn't have a show for all these years if it weren't for the Twiat Riot. We want to make it easier for you to get your enterprise fix every week. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you will find all of our back episodes ready for download. But more importantly, you'll find a little menu for subscribing. That means that you can automatically get Twiat in an audio format, in a video format, in a high-definition video format. It is the best way to support Twiat and the best way to make sure that we can keep doing this show for you. Also, don't forget that you can find me on my Twitter feed, twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll get to see who our guests are each week. You'll see the topics that we're going to be covering, and you'll be able to suggest topics for future shows. Again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, thanks to everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, to Lisa and Leo, who let us continue to do Twiat every week. To my fantastic engineer, who, she was over there a while back, Kara Cole. And to my wonderful TD, Kevin. You knew this was coming. This is the part of the show where we try to offer you some redemption by asking you a question from the episode. So this week's episode is, if we consider IP networking addressing for a 16-bit value, how many potential usable addresses exist?
Six.
Oh, so close, so close. The answer was actually 65,536. Everyone knows that one, but maybe you'll get it next time, Kevin. Until then, I am Father Robert Ballister, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.